Well, thank you, Dr. Pierce, for giving me the opportunity, and I was waiting just to offer some comments until the discussion was over. But yes, I mean, we're faced with a short-term problem and a long-term problem. The short-term problem is we have an assessment model which is performing at an acceptable level, but clearly is problematic. So we need to look at how we can improve the assessment model to address exactly the kinds of concerns that Loretta's been highlighting. And as it happens, there's a conference that's going to take place in Boston in the middle of next year, which is an international conference on stock assessment methodology, which is ICES. It's sponsored by many, including ICES, NOAA, FAO. And part of the process in preparing for that meeting is to take a number of candidate stocks worldwide and look at them very, very carefully in terms of how they perform or how applying a range of different assessment approaches to those stocks. And Eastern Georgia's Bank Yellowtail seems to be a very good candidate for that, and we're working on putting a team together to do exactly that. And that process, of course, will be open, and we'll keep everybody around the table informed. But it is empty for us to bring not just our best and brightest, but to bring some international perspective to this process, which is not unique to this region at all.
Anyone else on the council for Loretta? Loretta, thank you. Again. Tom?
So Karen spoiled my joke already. Sorry. Anyway, I was asked by the TMGC members to give the council an overview of how the U.S.-Canada shares are determined. And I'm going to spend a little bit of time on how the NIMS and DFO surveys are used in calculating those shares. And so I'm going to try and build us a tower here, and hopefully at the end of the presentation it's not going to fall over like the game Jenga. So there we go. Word of the day for those at TP score. That's not it. Okay. So I think it's important to remember that we calculate the shares based on a negotiation that took place with the Canadians back in the late 90s. And I think it's important to note that neither country got exactly what they wanted when we negotiated the sharing agreement. For example, the Canadians initially, when they walked in the room, they didn't want to consider anything that happened before the ruling on the U.S.-Canada boundary, basically nothing before 1985. And they wanted to downweight resource use because they said the U.S. has not been under a hard quota from the period 85 on, whereas we have been, so you shouldn't get credit for overfishing the stock. So this was their initial position on how to do things. And I think we also have to remember that a lot of the U.S. landing history was generated on the side of the line that we no longer have access to, on the eastern side of the line. I took sort of a very quick look, for example, during the period 83-84, just before the Hague Line decision. And I think somewhere around 20 or 30% of our yellowtail flounder catch was coming from the part of the ocean that we no longer have access to, for Georgia's Bank yellowtail flounder. The U.S., on the other hand, when we walked in the room, we wanted to consider the landings history over the entire time series, and by entire time series, we went back into the 60s is what I mean by that. And I think the U.S. also wanted to take into account that for much of that period, we were the ones who invested in the research on the bank. Our resource surveys took place, as you all know, through the 60s and 70s, and I don't think the Canadians actually started surveying the bank until around 85, 6. So we felt that that's what should be taken into advantage. Now, these were initial negotiating positions when we walked in the room, and they, of course, were modified, and eventually we reached an agreement. And the agreement was that we would consider two factors for the resource shares. they were weighted factors. One would be resource utilization, and this is a historic utilization. It's a fixed period. I think the years were 1967 to 1994, but it might have been 64 to 94. I should double check that. And then the second point was resource distribution as determined by surveys. When we started with the agreement, we created a table that said the resource utilization part would be weighted one way and the surveys weighted another. And over time, that weighting shifted from the resource utilization, to the survey. We're at the end of that cycle. Now 90% of the decision is based on the resource distribution and 10% of it is based on the resource use. Now, let me catch up to my notes, make sure we're all right here. Now, one of the reasons why the U.S. agreed to this was the underlying belief that as the stocks rebuilt, the resource would be distributed more evenly across the bank. And so we would benefit from rebuilding the stocks. Our resource share would go up and the resource distribution would go up over time. This seems to have been borne out for Georges Bank Haddock, which you'll see in a minute, which is the only one of the stocks that is actually rebuilt considerably over the time period. So, question came up at the Georges Bank Yellowtail Working Group and in a couple other places about how are the surveys actually used. So I thought I'd go into that a little bit. We use all of the NIMPS and Canadian surveys. We have a spring and fall. They have a, quote, spring, which takes place in February, which sure as heck isn't spring in New Hampshire, so it can't be spring in Canada. And we treat the survey slightly differently. For Georges Bank COD, we average the U.S. and Canadian spring surveys, and then we average that with a fall survey, whereas for the Yellowtail and Haddock, we average all three of them together. So this Y average is then smoothed with what's caused a low S smoother. And it's kind of important to note that there's a little bit of a lag here. We use the surveys, for example, in 2011 to contribute to what the share is going to be in 2013. So there's a little bit of a lag. So most of us in here really aren't familiar with what a low S smoother is. It's a locally weighted polynomial regression, which clears things right up, I think. Basically, what you're doing is you're taking each point of the survey and you're picking a neighborhood around that survey, meaning the points on either side, and you're fitting a regression to those points in the survey. And so you've got a lot of decisions to make. One is, how big is that window? And that's referred to a lot of different names. You'll see it called tension, span, window, nearest neighbor, whatever. But this, how wide that window is can influence the result. But there's another element of low-S smoothers that builds into this, and that is that the smoother we use is called a robust smoother, and what that means is that it tends to downweight outliers that are in that window. And you'll see how this has an effect in a minute. But first, to show you the influence of span, oops, shifting the wrong button. This is, I think, George's Yellowtail, and it's just three examples of how the smoother, which is the line, looks different depending what size of span or window or tension, whatever you want to call it, that is used here. And so what we're using at the track and the TMGC is this span of 0.3, which you can see goes down at the end. Well, if you used a span of 0.2, it reacts more quickly and it would go up. And if you used a span of 0.4, you know, the line starts to look almost straight as it goes through all the data. The choice of the span was agreed to and is part of the agreement and was built into the understanding. So that's not something we can readily change at this point. So it's worth a legitimate question, I guess, is how has the smoother affected the U.S.? I keep hitting the button. Sorry. So this is what we've got for Georges Bank COD, and you're going to see three of these. The blue line is basically the results of averaging the surveys. The red line is when you put the smoother through here. I'm only looking at through 2001 through 2011, which is why it doesn't look very smooth, to be honest with you. If we stretch this out over 30 years, it wouldn't look quite so ragged. But as you might expect, sometimes the smoother tends to make the survey average higher than it is in any given year when you apply the smoother, and sometimes it's lower. If you look at the circles, these are all the points where it was higher than it was in any given year. Now, we've only been using this in U.S. management since 2004, so those are really the only circles you want to look at. This is what it looks like for Eastern Georgia's Bank Cod. This is what it looks like for Eastern Georgia's Bank Haddock. Now, this is, I think, perhaps what we sort of was hoping would happen of every stock. As the stock rebuilt, you can see that the survey indices started to go up, and they did go up from 2001, where the distribution was about 10%, to 2009, where it looks like it peaked out up at around 41 or 42%. And it's dropped off a little bit, which, you know, people won't like this, but the fact is the stock is declining a little bit, and we're seeing the distribution go down a little bit. Maybe that's just a coincidence, but this is sort of a thought process that we had that might take place. If you look at Georgia's Bank Yellowtail Flounder, this is how it impacts. Now, you can see the points here, and this is what, of course, attracted a lot of attention to everybody at the Georgia's Yellowtail Working Group. You notice that the survey, which is pretty erratic in the last few years, we had some real low points in here in some surveys, and then we've got a real high points in here where the survey jumps up to, I think, 87% or something like that. And yet, when you apply the smoother, you say, what's going on here? The smoother actually goes down. And this is a result of what the lowest smoother does with downweighting the survey points. And I'm going to show you, I think, to illustrate this. If you look on the left, this is not quite the smoother we use, but it's close enough for this graph. Circles are the data points, the raw average of the three surveys. The line is the lowest smoother. 86% is where we were in 2011. And you can see that, you know, it goes down a little bit. And so you get this somewhat counterintuitive result where if you imagine that in 2011 that we only had 65% on our side of the line, well, son of a gun, our share would have been up closer to, not our share, the smoother would have gone up closer to about 50%. It's like 48 or somewhere in there. This is because it's not as much of an outlier, and so the lowest smoother doesn't downweight it as much. So this is what I mean by saying lowest has a downweighting in it, and this influences us. So if we go back to what it actually looks like, this is where we're at. And so, you know, the conclusion with the smoother, sometimes it works in your favor, sometimes it doesn't. This, you talk about coincidences, this is a pretty big one. Since 2004, there have been 24 U.S.-Canada quotas set. The smooths, if you take all those into account, if you counted up the circles while I was going through them, the smooth survey was higher than the raw survey in exactly 12 instances. So, you know, time it worked in our favor, half it didn't, which is a good result, perhaps just strictly a coincidence because of the year we did this, but it shows that you really don't have any bias that's resulting as a survey. So what might happen next year? I mean, it's hard to say. If the raw survey average is above roughly 50% in 2000, we would expect that the smoother would go up, start to go up, and the higher above it was, the more it would go up. If the raw average is somewhere between 40 to 45%, which we've seen, I guess, once, which is in 2008, then the smoother might decline a little bit. And those are ballpark numbers. Don't take any of those to the bank. So ultimately, when you put all this stuff together, this is the end result. Once you combine the smooth survey average and you combine the catch, which now counts for only 10% of the survey distribution, this is what you see what's happened. You can see that in the case of Georgia's Bank Haddock, the increase in the distribution has outweighed the decline in the weighting of the landings history over time, and we've seen a gradual increase of our share of Eastern Georgia's Bank Haddock, at least up till 2012, and then in the last year we've seen a slight decline. On the other hand, if you look at Georgia's Bank Yellowtail, you can see that it was staying between 70 to 80% about 2009. And then we've seen a big drop since about 2009 and down to this year's percentage. If you look at Eastern Georgia's Bank Cod, you know, we had a slight increase going maybe up until 2009, and then it appears that we've got a slide in our share down to about 2013. The historic shares are also shown up there in parentheses, and that's basically the landings history over that time period that I talked about. You can see that, generally speaking, Haddock is close to our historic share on Eastern Georgia's Bank Haddock, and the other two stocks are really not close to what our historic catch share has been since then. So that covers the overview of how the shares are distributed.
Questions for Tom? Mark?
Have you said that the initial step of evaluating the information is averaging the surveys? What actually gets averaged? Is it the raw kilograms per tow, or is there some biomass swept expansion does? How do they get brought into comparability before there's an averaging process?
We use the surveys and converted to swept area biomass, and then the swept area biomass on each side of the line is determines the proportion in each survey, and then that's what's averaged. There were some questions raised. There's often questions raised about the Bigelow. First off, are you using a big calibration on the Bigelow? The answer is, and Chris will jump up if I get this wrong, the answer is no. We're just you don't need to do a calibration because it's all the calculations are done within a year for the swept area biomass. There was also an issue that the track explored with respect to, is this really working if the size distributions are different on either side of the line? And an exploration of that a few years ago found that the surveys are essentially catching the same sized fish, so there doesn't seem to be a problem with differential sizes on either side of the line.
I'm sure we're probably not using the same net, but do we use the same sweep?
I don't know. I don't know that it matters if we're using the same sweep. I suspect we're not using the exact same sweep. It's a relative biomass index on either side of the line within a survey that's used. We're not necessarily comparing one survey to the other.
Well, if we're determining percentages based on the survey, we could game the system by going out there with a flounder sweep and radically increasing our yellowtail catch in the survey.
No, we wouldn't, because what happens is, just as a simple example, made-up example, if one survey were to catch 100 fish total and caught 50 of them on one side and 50 on the other side, the proportions would be 50% in that survey. If the next survey went out and caught only 50 fish but caught 25 on one side and 25 on the other, its conclusion would be that one caught 50% on each side of the line. And so, they would be saying the exact same thing in that case, even though one survey caught twice as many fish as the other survey. Now, if they were to somehow, for some reason, then that would result in different catches on different sides of the line, I guess that's possible, but that it might have an influence between them. But even then, I'm not sure it would, because you're doing that proportion calculation within each survey.
Okay, if we're both surveying each other's waters, that's what I didn't take into account. I thought we were just surveying our waters and they were surveying their waters.
No, we survey, both surveys survey both sides of the line, and so both surveys come up with a proportion on each side of the line.
So basically it's a check on each other.
Yes.
John Bullard.
Tom, thanks for this summary. I just want to link this discussion to something we were talking about when I was reporting on topics that were brought up during the listening session when people, and Rick, you weren't for that, but people were talking about how fish populations are moving due to changes in water, anything else like that. And how if fish populations are moving northward and that is accelerating, that if you talk about basing allocations on historical catches, we we might have to think about different ways of doing that. And so here, Tom is a way that two have tried to resolve that by setting up a system that used the equivalent of historical catches, and over a period of time, moved from historical catches to distribution. And NRCC is going to meet at some point in the future, and we also, from state to state, are going to look at the issue of stocks moving, and also think about, you know, will we have to think about ways to deal with stocks moving, and how might we? Here's a lesson in a formula. Maybe it's a good lesson. Maybe it's not a lesson, but you know, it's one way to deal with a situation.
David Pierce.
Yeah, Tom. Do you know if there are any criteria or any conditions in the understanding that would actually trigger a reconsideration of the terms of the understanding? In other words, does it go on forever, or does something happen, something specified in the understanding that would bring us back to the table to take a look at the way things are and maybe the way things need to be in the future?
Well, I'm not aware of anything in the understanding that automatically generates a review of any of the understanding's provisions. You know, between the Transboundary Management Guidance Committee and the Steering Committee, which is sort of the supervisory body over that, I think they can choose to, but I don't believe there's anything in the understanding that says, you know, we'll review stuff every 5 years, every 10 years, or whenever.
So that would mean then that John and his counterpart in Canada would have to decide to discuss the issue, and of course John would have to offer up some compelling reasons why it's a good idea to talk some more, and consider such things as the issue that John just raised, the shifting populations, environmental conditions. So that's I guess the only avenue that could be used to revisit the understanding. It's my assumption.
If you would like.
Yeah, I think the argument we want more fish would probably not be the compelling reason. So it ends up a 10-year, but there is no trigger to reevaluate. It just goes on until someone says that it doesn't work. But there is no automatic trigger there.
I think it's also, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think to point out management is at a ministerial level in Canada, if I understand correctly. So it would be more complicated than you sitting down with your counterpart. This would have to probably go through state.
Anyone else for Tom? Drew?
Drew Minkiewicz, Fisher Survival Fund. Sorry, but I'm sitting here wondering, where's the urgency? We are talking about St. George's Bank, Yellowtail Flounder, a stock where we've historically caught 98%. The current catch trends are still in that range of us catching well over 90%, yet we're in an agreement where we're getting 44%. And we're talking about taking away a directed fishery that's supported the Port of New Bedford, and we're talking about seriously restraining our most profitable fishery. Where is the urgency? Why are we not talking about how 44% of something we catch over 90% of is not acceptable? Are we just going to say that's it? That's fine. That's all we do. I mean, we're also sitting here in the audience listening to. I don't understand why there's an emergency when there's $160 million being lost to the economy. Is that the position of the administration? $160 million isn't an emergency? Where is the urgency? There are real problems here. Can we please talk about some possible solutions? We're just getting a little frustrated looking at this. We catch over 90% of the yellowtail. Always have, still are.
we're getting 44%. That's not acceptable. We're looking to down fisheries. And here we are. We can give ourselves some relief. The Canadians use yellowtail as bycatch. They only need around 200 metric tons or less. Yet we're giving them more that they're not going to use. Why? Why are we not talking about ways that we can possibly do something about this?
Drew, the fact is that we have started talking with the Canadians about that. You were there. You listened to it. Approached the idea of looking at the agreement. Did not get a very positive response out of it. That got elevated to the steering committee. There are parts of it that will likely be looked at in the intersessional, not all of it, and may not come out the way we would want it. But secondarily, we are talking about the trading issue with them. That is one of the items that is on the intersessional thing. So, I mean, we have started the discussions with them. If you know, and I understand the frustration, but you know, the response and how these things normally go just isn't going to go as fast as we need it to go, but it is at least moving. Anyone else?
Mary Beth.
Still finishing up with the audience. Back to the council, Mary Beth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just had a couple of questions about that, and I was trying to recall the date that they were polling for this intersessional meeting. And the reason I ask that is if we weren't able to actually come up with some agreement to trade, for example, do we have a process in place here that would allow us to then come back and implement that trade in 2013? So it's kind of a little bit of a process thing. And then as far as one note that I took, as Loretta was giving her presentation, was this: the TMGAC adopted a strategy to maintain a low mortality limit reference, which is often referred to as a strategy. Of course, we discussed this at the meeting, and yet I was frustrated, as I think people knew, because we received advice from our SSC that was different, and the interpretation seemed to be very bound by this portion of the strategy to go in this direction, the flexibility that the SSC provided us. So is this part of the agreement, and could this be discussed at our intersessional? Is one part, and then any decision make at the intersessional have to go back here in the U.S. implemented in the
It would have to come back and be approved by the council if we came up with some sort of trading scheme. Okay, it would have to come back and be approved by the council. I'm going to have to ask Jean or George to help me with how if the council approves it and we wanted to go ahead with something. How would that be implemented, through an amendment, or would it framework? Or is there, since it's an international agreement, is there some other mechanism for us to get something in place?
I don't think so. You'd have to do it within the parameters of the groundfish fishery management plan. I don't think there's a provision in there that allows for this kind of intersessional adjustment to be done at the request of the council. You know, there's always the emergency provision that's available. But I don't know. I would need more time to reflect on it and talk to people about it to see if there's, you know, any other way to do it. But that's my initial reaction. I don't know if George or Tom or anybody else who knows these the process, or they have a different view of this.
My initial reaction is the same as yours. I don't know of any special provision to do something out of the ordinary, but there could be one.
And Mary Beth, your second question was, Tom.
Yeah, I mean, I think Mary Beth had two questions, and I'm not sure which one Gene and George answered. If there was a, you know, the first is if trading results in a change in the quotas. It seems to me that I don't know in a timely fashion, but it seems to me that that's just a change in the quota, U.S.-Canada quota, so that might not be too difficult to implement, maybe. The second question that I think she asked was, what if we wanted to change the agreed-upon harvest strategy, you see, right? And I'm not sure that's actually, I'd have to go back and check. I'm not sure that's actually written, put in an appendix in Amendment 13, but I'm not sure that's actually specified in Amendment 13. But revising the agreed upon harvest strategy, I think, would run into, depending what came out of it, would run into implications with the requirement in the International Fishery Agreement Clarification Act that we still have to end overfishing. So, I mean, there's some limits on how far we could go with revising the harvest strategy.
Well, through the chair, just to follow up, I think, though, in this particular instance, it would be worth having a discussion about what, you know, alternative strategies could be considered when and how. I mean, if you have a stock assessment that, you know, really performs poorly, holding yourself to this strategy, right, we would have limited by the ABC that the ABC provides us here, and we would have just been in a better place with this negotiation had we been able to use that strategy. It seemed to me that our advice would have been not. So that's why I asked the question.
Yeah, I hadn't gotten to the second part. That's correct. I mean, we have to adhere to the track advice as far as the science that is used in thing, and that may be something that we can talk to them about, but in discussions with actually they've been open discussions too, but in my discussions with the Canadian co-chair, one of the concerns that they have had is our process very much driven by the SSC. And their sense is that we come into these meetings with our hands tied, and that you know, we have to adhere to something that in some cases they already know about. Last year we had the issue where the subsequent TMGC came up with a number that was within the track range, but was larger than the one that we had negotiated with the Canadians. That's why we were able to go back and ask them to open up the negotiation again.
So just to quickly follow up, it just seemed to me that our discussions about where we would be starting and ending on this were around this FRF discussion. Yet the Canadians, who seem to have agreed with this, when we talked to them afterwards, they said, well, they would have gone much higher. So they didn't feel bound by that. And yet here in the document it says this is the adopted strategy and we got to stick with it. And so, but they didn't seem like that they needed to stick with it. Is this strategy actually written up into agreement, or is it just something that TMGC developed through the stock assessment process along the way? If it's not, you know, an official part of the agreement, then I was just hoping perhaps we could have it on the agenda for this meeting that's coming up and have more discussions about that.
Gene?
I mean, when I was thinking about how we could respond quickly to a traded increase, and one possible way I think we can explore, I'm sure it's
doable till we explore it is in setting location in the 48 that we're doing it, that we set up a range perhaps that and depending on whether we get additional attack from the Canadians later on, then that will automatically be adjusted accordingly, so that we set up the flexibility in the current action going forward that establishes the TAC with a flexibility adjuster built in at that time. And therefore, you know, we still might have to go through Federal Register notice or something, but we wouldn't have to do it as an emergency. The council wouldn't have to take action and can possibly be done quicker. So that's one thing we can explore.
John?
There's several issues here which I want to bring up, and if I get something wrong, either George or Jane will hammer me and correct it, all right? And I'm new to this, so please excuse me if I get this wrong. So in talking to my counterpart on the Canadian side, she is very willing to offer a trade and transfer, and in a way that I think would be acceptable to our folks in terms of what we are trading. And to do that, the intersessional is in late February, by the way, and to do that in a way that, you know, is done on a year-to-year basis, not just this year, a year-to-year basis. And I think she's doing that on the assumption that we don't blow up the understanding, right? The key is that we don't blow up the understanding. The understanding is that the shared TAC on Yellowtail is 500. That's what is agreed to. So, you know, we have a history of going back and, you know, saying, well, no, we don't like that. We won't want a different number. So, you know, I think if we go back again and say we don't like that number, the idea of a trade and transfer, you know, that may be a casualty of that. That's something we have to think about. So all of these things get knitted together. Now, the other thing that the SSC talked about in the presentation, I guess it was yesterday or this morning, I can't remember, was, you know, these three numbers, 200, 400 to 500, and then this word I've never heard before, a backstop number. I don't know what backstop means. Of what was it, 1,050 or 1,150, whatever it was, whatever backstop meant, and which was last year's catch. And but the main message, which I don't think got enough underlining, Chris, was that, and which I was at the meeting, was the conclusion that everyone seemed to agree on, that Yellowtail should be a bycatch fishery, that it should be a bycatch fishery. Whatever we do, whatever the council does, it should be a bycatch fishery. And so the challenge for the council is what steps do we take to make it a bycatch fishery? And that's the important work for the council. How do we make it a bycatch fishery? Now, one of the things we have to do that we, the regional office, has to make sure is the number that you set does not create overfishing. And that's what, and I think 500 meets that threshold. I don't know about the backstop number. I'm pretty sure that doesn't. So we have to judge that. So the trade and transfer can help, all right? But I don't think that's necessarily, and Canada has something to trade. It doesn't have an infinite number, right? It has something. And many people have pointed out, they harvest almost no yellowtail, right? So they harvest almost no yellowtail. So there's a reason for them to want to trade, because, but It helps solve a piece of the problem. It's not the silver bullet, but it's a piece of the problem. But it'll work if we don't blow up the understanding.
Maggie?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Maggie Raymond, Associated Fisheries of Maine. I have to say that I'm troubled by this discussion about this confusion about what mechanism would be used to facilitate some kind of trade between us and our Canadian counterparts. And I'm confused because I attended the SSE meeting in late August when Sam Rauch said, you know, we got a crisis. We're going to find every, you know, thing that we can do to mitigate this crisis. And one of the things that we're looking at is potentially a trade. So between August, late August, and today, nothing has been done to figure out how we're going to do that for this coming fishing year. I don't understand. I thought it was the way that Sam was talking about it. All we needed to do was decide what amount would be traded. And, you know, granted, there isn't much to be of yellowtail for them to trade back to us if we go with the 500 number, which it sounds like we're going to do, but we need every single one of those pounds. And so we can't wait until February. We have to get some kind of negotiation going with them for some simple one-time deal that we do for this year, and then you work on the longer-term strategy and how we do trades over the long term when we're in these situations. But again, I don't know how we can at this time after that SSC meeting when it sounded like, you know, oh, we're working on this, figure out how to do it, and now we don't know how to do it.
What? He meant we were doing it, and I talked with my Canadian counterpart, 3 weeks afterwards. So, yes, we are working on a trade and transfer.
I could follow up, but if we have to now develop some mechanism that's going to be inserted in Framework 48, I mean, I just don't see how we have the to do that. It has to be some other mechanism other than a framework. That thing has to go through proposed rule and final rule and all that. We need to know much sooner than that whether or not it's going to be any more fish coming to our side.
Vito?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Vito Giugoloni, Northeast Seafood Coalition. Council intent, I think, would be good just to put out on the table. If the council were to say, if NOAA GC or whoever looks through to see what mechanism could actually be used, at least the council will have spoken. You're together today. If there were a motion that said, you know, I was up in Canada, and it seems to me, I think the industry there is willing to let go of whatever their scallop fishery doesn't need, is what it sounds like. And, you know, I would think something offered to say, hey, if we can get 60 tons, 70 ton of yellowtail for up to some amount of Georges Bank haddock, there may be an interest in that up there. And then is there any way that you could have a conference call, or is there anything in the TMGC mechanism to allow the TMGC to reconvene? I mean, if the TMGC doesn't have a unanimous yes on this, yeah, we'll accept it. Isn't that mechanism already there? We're still working within the 500 ton, so we're not changing the management strategy at all. We're still harvesting the same F reference, so it's just a matter of 60 more ton being on the U.S. side. So I don't know how rigid that agreement is, that you've got to go by the shares, the split that we have right now, so that 44% is on the U.S. side. You know, if the Canadians agree and you have a committee based on a recommendation from this council, meet and say, can we have a conference call at TMGC and move that fish over? You know, you get out of the, we don't want to see the TMGC have to make those unilateral decisions, but I think if the council says it, you can do it. I know you probably have to have public notice. When's the next council meeting? I mean, we're not moving fast enough here. We're going to end up with a shutdown before we start.
Just a couple of comments. I think the appropriate level for it, at least, is at the steering committee versus the TMGC. Our Canadian counterparts were reluctant to sort of get into some of those issues without being approved at a higher level. They also were asked about us getting some of the unused quota, and you're correct. They said yes, but we're not doing it without you giving us something in return. And the last time this council voted on trading, the vote was no. That was at the June meeting. So it's something that needs to be readdressed. And we went ahead at the TMGC just trying to begin a dialogue so that we could come back with something more concrete for the council to decide on.
Mr. Chairman, I think it's in our view, it's an entirely different policy discussion, and we agreed to be very cautious to have the TMGC authority change and have that negotiation of trading happen at that level. If it happens at the council level, then you have the full public process. Everyone's involved. Everyone understands the implications. So if there's a large sort of no-brainer fishery trade that could occur, for instance, Georges Bank East Haddock for Georges Bank Yellowtail, there's nothing to lose to have this council make a recommendation to the steering committee to say, float that balloon. If it happens, it happens. If it doesn't, at least the will of the council has been put forward from a management strategy.
Tom.
So the chair already mentioned one thing I wanted to point out, which was the council was approached and voted 1-15 not to pursue trading about a year and a half ago. And that's the only council vote on record. So it would be good if the council wants to pursue this to explain it. I think it's important to highlight some of the reasons that the vote was that way. One was because of existing workloads, which certainly haven't gotten any lighter. And the other were some concerns about the implications for trading on individual permit holders in a sector allocation system. You know, assuming we were to get 80 metric tons or 100 metric tons from the Canadians, where do they go? Do they all go to the scallop fishery? Do they all go to the groundfish fishery and get divvied up? And where does the fish that's leaving the haddock, presumably that the Canadians will want, where does that come from? If you've got a guy who has a very small amount of PSC for Eastern Georges Bank haddock and was planning to go fishing for it, and now we've just traded it away, and now his small piece, even smaller piece, because we gave them 2,000 or 3,000 metric tons of haddock, you know, how does he weigh in on this process, and what does he get in return if the fish goes to a different fishery? So these are some of the complications, I think, that a year and a half ago the council was wrestling with and said, okay, we need to think about how all this stuff interacts before we pursue trading. Now, this admittedly is a different situation. When we were talking about it a year and a half ago, we were not facing quotas nearly as low as what we're talking about now. So maybe that creates additional sense of urgency. But I think it's important in highlighting that there are some things that will have to be sorted out very quickly if we're, you know, if we successfully trade with the Canadians.
Anyone else on the council? I see Mary Beth and Chairman Robbins.
Well, I think Tom raised some, you know, issues that certainly were part of that past discussion. And at that time, we didn't have numbers that were as low as they are now. I don't think the crisis, impending crisis, was the same. But I do have one question for Tom. When we talk about these allocations that will be made to sectors, those are the allocations that are in the current framework. Is that correct? So those allocations haven't actually been made.
Yes, that's correct. The allocations have not been made yet for next year. The council hasn't made decisions, for example, on what the scallop fishery allocation will be. So those have not yet been made. But, you know, I don't know how far along the sectors are on planning their activities.
So, I mean, my assumption is should any trade take place, it's going to come off the top of the total before the allocations go up to the sectors. So it would be very difficult to assess down to the individual boat level what impact, you know, these small numbers would have as far as haddock goes. You know, the haddock tack total is large, and the yellowtail total is very small. So we know that adding 60 ton, for example, to the yellowtail will have a positive impact on the overall fleet, whether you're a scallop fisherman or a groundfish fisherman. We would need to figure out how to divvy it up, and that the haddock deduction would have little impact because we're not even taking what the haddock is now. So in light of that, I think I would like to make a motion. And my motion would be that that the council request that the U.S.-Canada Steering Committee negotiate with our Canadian counterparts for a one-time request to swap up to 200 metric ton of Georges Bank East haddock from the U.S. 2013 share in return for at least 60 metric ton of Georges Bank Yellowtail from the Canadian 2013 share.
Could I suggest that you leave the numbers out, let us negotiate?
I would consider leaving the numbers out. I did wonder about being so specific.
Leave the numbers. Would you leave the numbers out?
Well, it doesn't really convey where we're at, but we'll leave the numbers out. So forget about the numbers, Karen.
I am going to ask that before we ask for a second that we do this either at groundfish or under other business tomorrow. Okay.